thanks everybody. Thanks for organizing. This is awesome. What I'm going to do, I wanted to make sure people knew why we should care about BioCrest before I launched into what's going to happen to them in the future. And so I do have new stuff for people who already know about them. So just stay patient and don't get bored until we get there. So why do we care about these guys? What we're talking about are these cute little bumpy things in the foreground here. Although they don't look like that everywhere you go, but this is the Colorado Plateau where they're a very dominant part of the landscape. We certainly, if you looked at dominant vegetation type for ecological site descriptions or something, it's these guys. It's not those weeny little plants out there. Okay, so what are they? They're basically cyanobacteria and fungi kind of make the cake, and then the frosting on top are the mosses and lichens. But those cyanobacteria and fungi really weave those soils together and are the substance of it with these other guys on top. But these are the flashy guys, the lichens and the mosses that you actually see with your vision, with your eye, because the other components are microbial. So where are they? They're in most dry lands worldwide, and also in polar dry lands. So you get them in Antarctica and the Arctic. So I don't have that on here. But about almost up to 40% of terrestrial land surfaces, these guys may have a really major part to play in ecosystem function. And they're in surprising vegetation types, and like, you know, they're even in forests. If you have very low productivity forests, you can have them. And lots of grasslands where you might not expect them, and even subhumid landscapes in Alaska, you know, if you have tree fall. Wherever the light can reach the soil surface, you're probably going to have some form of soil crust. And it can even be tree gaps in tropical forests. They'll be there for a while until they get revegetated with trees. So they're a pretty big deal. So why do we care about them? We care about them. The two biggie things is that they're really important for soil fertility and they're really important for soil stability. And soil fertility, they're very good at capturing dust. They roughen the surface. They're sticky, and the dust comes in, and it sticks, and it's often carrying a lot of nutrients. They also fix carbon and nitrogen and help phosphorus become more available. And often they are the main source of nitrogen for these ecosystems. So that can be a really big role they play. They also, as you can see here, capture litter and water because they roughen the soil surface. And so it's really hard for resources to just sheet off if they hit these roughened surfaces. They're very important for albedo. They darken the soil surface, and so they're going to alter the soil surface temperature. And that has large implications over landscape areas for climate models and carbon models. And they also, because they produce carbon through carbon fixation, they feed the soil food web, so underneath a better, well-developed soil crust, you'll have much higher diversity and abundance of soil biota, and therefore that's going to influence plant litter transformation rates. And because I should say also that darker soil means that the soil temperatures are going to be higher, and so nutrient transformation rates are going to be higher as well. And if you do pots, stupid little pot studies in the greenhouse, you get this result over and over again. If you stick crust in a pot without and not pots and you grow plants in them, you always get bigger, juicier plants growing in the crusted ones. Because there's a lot more nitrogen in there. It's not really very surprising, which is why I call it kind of duh. We have some very interesting little things that we've been pondering for a long time that are not quite germane to this talk, but still very interesting, and that's that we've been trying to figure out this nitrogen cycle in drylands for years and not just the Colorado Plateau, and it does not balance. Our input rates are way, way higher than we just can't find the nitrogen. We see it going in and we can't find it again. We know that we get fluxes out. We know we have water erosion and wind erosion. We know we have leaching, but it's very limited. And so something that we've been struggling with for a long time is, okay, they're the main source of nitrogen for these systems, except for where is it? It's nowhere to be found. So is that really true? You know, what are we really saying here? But we just recently, groups of people have started looking at the transfer of nitrogen between the soil crusts and plants directly via fungal networks that are biocrust fungi. The bulk transfer can happen up to 24 hours per meter away to the nearby plant. And so this may actually solve our problem that the nitrogen that's being fixed is going directly over to the nearby plant and getting sucked up, which would be super awesome because in the last 30 years of my life, we'll finally have some resolution to it. And the extra cool part is that it's probably dark septate fungi. They're the dominance in the soil crust. There's very few mycorrhizae in there, and they don't have to go through the roots. And so this may be a whole new mechanism for plants obtaining nutrients in dry lands, and that's via the dark septates. And they can actually go through a stem. They can go up a stem and through the stomates and the leaf. They can reside inside the leaf. I mean, these guys are awesome. My friend who studies them said, don't think of a plant as a plant. Think of it instead of a structure upon which the dark septates hang. So they're pretty vital in deserts, and this may be a whole new world to be exploring. Tell Jerry I said that. It was his quote. These guys are also really important for soil stability. We've got a lot of sparse vegetation out there. We've got really steep hillsides, and we get very little erosion if you don't disturb them. So what's gluing them is that cyanobacteria, fungi, lichens, mosses, if they're around. So they're really important for this more than anything else. And here's why. You've got these filaments that link sand grain to sand grain. They can make soil aggregates. They can make just these nets going between soil particles, which then connect even larger particles together, and which are not going to blow or wash away because they're just so big and connected. And they make these little mats that you can literally hold up the soil and it's glued together. And that's just sand. And it's glued together in something that doesn't fall apart when you pick it up. They're very influential in local hydrologic cycles, but what they do depends on the site. It depends on the soil. It just depends, period. And if anyone tells you a crust does this or that, say they're nuts. They don't know what they're talking about because you need to know all about the soil. Before you say that, you need to know all about the soil composition. I mean, the species composition of the soil crust before you say that. So there is no grand unifying theory yet, but we're working hard on it. We're trying. But there is one thing, and that's that, of course, infiltration is that tension between soil surface roughness and permeability. So the more crust you have, the rougher it is, but the more organisms you have that are clogging up the soil pores. And so also for evaporation, those soil pores are clogged. And so you're going to have more difficulty getting water evaporating out to the same degree you had it infiltrating in. So it's all these tensions. And that's why it's impossible to say with any definiteness about any particular site without measuring it. These guys are also very important for vascular plant species composition. And this is a new body of work. I'll show you in a slide in a minute. That if you have a large seed that's trying to get in something that's impermeable like that surface right there, it's going to have a very hard time making it. A lot of our invasive annuals here in the western U.S., oh, I guess we're not in the western U.S., over there in the western U.S., are big-seeded. And so they have a very hard time penetrating well-developed soil crusts. Until you smash them, then they have higher nitrogen and phosphorus and carbon, so then it's a heyday, and the invasives do just fine. So what can we expect in the future? And here's where there's new stuff. We have a lot of stuff going on in the western U.S. We used to worry mostly about the soil surface churning by hooves and motorcycles and trucks and cars and people and all that. We're now sort of confronting a whole new beast, and that's energy exploration and development. It's impacting huge amounts of landscape in the western U.S., and scraping surfaces and creating roads and creating a whole new set of things to think about. And fire is increasing, and it's in a way that we haven't really seen before. It's along with those invasive grasses. Now we're having lots more fires. I mean, low elevation fires, not forest fires. So it's really it's a whole new way of thinking about what's the fate of soil crust in the future. And then we have those invisible things like increases in temperature, decreases in precip, end deposition, all that kinds of stuff that's going to happen as well. So what do we know? Well, one thing we know is that if you stomp these soils, they do erode. And when they erode, they change the structure of that surface. So Jeff talked about connectivity of the landscape and the gaps that you can create by clipping grasses or whatever, and about how you then get more movement of soil and water. And that's exactly what you see happen. If you smash out the crust and the soils start to erode, what you do is you go from a situation like this where you've got interspace plants and you've got, this is Arches National Park, and these are like literally 10 feet apart because this is on the way to an arch and that's not. And so basically you stomp the interspace down and what you get is this hump like this, like, which is a very different landscape shape than used to be there, at both a 1 meter plot scale and a slightly larger landscapey scale. And you know, if you're a bunny or a mouse, that really matters. You're going to have a whole lot less cover. You've lost your interspace vegetation. So there's really this influence on how much water and soil movement there's going to continue to be. What does it mean for the animals that inhabit that area? There's going to be some very large impacts for them. Nutrient cycling basically had stopped in this area here. There was no nutrients going in, burnt nitrogen. There's no carbon going in. And there was lots going out, so I guess it didn't stop. It was pretty devoid of soil fauna in there. It was a pretty sterile environment. Deserts, people like to think of sterile anyway, but that was seriously sterile. We also have a lot of dust coming off of disturbed surfaces when they lose their soil crust. So we ran around with a car and we drove over all sorts of different soil types. And that gold, those gold bars over there, this is the dust flux off of the surfaces. The gold bars is after we drove our Suburban over it twice. And you can see that most desert surfaces, regardless of soil type, this doesn't show up very well, does it? Those little blue bars are the undisturbed surface. And it's just pretty low, no matter where you are, except for fine sands, which blow even if you just look at them. And I put that there just to remind myself to say some soils just blow, like the edges of playas and down in washes where you've had a lot of soil, recent water movement that have churned soils up. It just blows. But that's not most of deserts. Most of deserts are these other surfaces that are quite stable until you disturb them. And then when you do disturb them, you can get massive amounts of sediment blowing like those pictures there or washing like those pictures there. We do a lot of work with dust in Moab, and the implications of dust are huge, both economically, health-wise, and then regional water supplies. Water, the snow melts a lot faster when it's got dust on the surface, and so you get a lot less input of water into the big rivers. So there's a lot of reasons to worry about dust at that bigger scale. When you lose your soil crust, you also suddenly get a lot more nutrients moving off-site via water. This is a rainfall simulator, and a cyanocrust is kind of equivalent to a recently disturbed crust that is just, it's early successional. That dark crust, lichen crust, is a late successional. And you can see you get a lot more runoff, a lot faster. You get a lot more sediment coming off of those sites, and of course the water and the sediment has both carbon and nitrogen in it. And where you have those disturbed areas, you have a lot more loss of carbon and nitrogen. So, you know, you're just creating. And I have to say, given the amount of landscape that we've disturbed globally, we've done this massive experiment on the impacts of surface disturbance in desert soils. Of course, it's not a controlled experiment, so we don't know, like, what we learned from it, but we've certainly done it, and I have altered these systems in tremendously dramatic ways. And I didn't have any pictures for this, so I just wanted to say quickly that we've also looked at elevated CO2 effects on crust, and we basically didn't see much. We saw some elevation right away, but they compensated for it, and in which they had enhanced photosynthesis, as you would expect, and then they compensated for it, and we really didn't see anything by the end of it. And end deposition, they love nitrogen. They don't have to fix it. So suddenly nitrogen is free. They'll incorporate it if they're next to a power plant or Los Angeles or anything like that, or if you add it, and they are very happy to suck it up and stop then having to fix it. So it does not affect them in a negative way at all. In fact, they're cheerful consumers of it. So increasing temperatures, so one of those invisible things. So lichens basically hate it. It can take a very long time for them to demonstrate this. In the field, it didn't. We just happened to be sampling the year where they just dropped dramatically. You can see we had a sampling time at 67. And we went back to the exact same site, and we had the exact same number, more or less, in 96. But then that next year was a very hot and dry year, and they just crashed. And this is Kallima 10X, which is our main soil lichen out there. It's our main nitrogen fixer, so this does spell some implication for these ecosystems in terms of nitrogen availability, and this was very highly correlated with temperature. And honest, I didn't draw the line first and then put the dots on. It really did come out that way. I couldn't believe it. I was like, really? But it was true. And that has implications for carbon fixation. This is a little hard to understand, but the dark is the control, and then the red line that's above it is what happens if you warm it. And so some of these red lines go above the next dark line, and the dark lines are our replicates. But you can see that basically, so this is the control, and here's that red line. This is the control, and that's its red line. This is the control, and that's its red line. That's the next control, and that's its red line. So you get really huge increases in carbon flux loss these are losses. So you get this huge losses when you warm these soil crusts. You can also create chaos if you water small events frequently. And probably because they gear up and start respiring when they get wet, they have no way of controlling that. And then they dry down before they can replace that respired carbon, and then they just basically die after a while. And we did it in a very short time period. You can see here, because we were only watering in the summer for a couple of weeks, so we decreased the population in half the first summer and basically killed them all by the second. So it took very little time for us to nuke the mosses in the system. And that was with watering. And these were in uncovered plots. So they got all their normal precip. So they've actually got more precip. It's just that we changed the delivery pattern. And what they couldn't handle was more of these small events. And there's no telling what's going to happen in the future. You know, we don't know in terms of precip timing and event sizes and things. But if it's more small precip, these guys are pretty much toast. And I should also add, I don't think I have a slide, that we've had warming lamps out now for 11 years. And finally, we are seeing the mosses and the lichens die under the warming lamps. It took a really long time. So these guys responded to the wetting right away, but it's been 2005, now it's 2017. And the mosses and lichens, we've lost about half of them in the warmed only plot. So, you know, it's taken a really long time, speaking of needing for long-term studies, but we're actually losing them. So that is a nice corollary to that other study we saw where we saw that huge drop in the lichens pretty immediately. News is we're probably going to lose them. And when we lose them, we do a lot to the nitrogen cycle. So we notice that with the loss of the mosses, the same thing is going to happen with the lichens, and that's that we go from an NH4 economy. And what I mean is that these guys fix nitrogen and then they leak it to the underlying soil as ammonium. But what's happening now is suddenly we're seeing nitrate in down there instead. And that's not great news because nitrate is much more easily lost via leaching and volatilization. So we are going to have a much more leaky to nitrogen system than we once had. And this is super cool stuff that's new from China. This is 512 plots. Only the Chinese could do a study like this. 10 meter squared plots over this ginormous desert. I mean, ginormous. and they measured these 2 to 4 times over a 4-year period, and they went and recorded every single plant growing in the plot and what kind of crust it was growing through. Then they collected all the seeds from those plants plus 150 other species to characterize sort of the general, you know, what are the seeds characteristics of this area. They then characterized the seed bank to see what kinds of seeds were in there. I mean, it just like was staggering amount of work. And the answer is staggering. Basically, that if you have a bare soil, you have, so these are seeds with appendages. So they're like that picture I showed you. They have really big seeds. I mean, not the seed, but you know, the whole thing, appendage in the seed. And then you've got seeds that are really smooth and really small. Well, they don't have to be small, but they're smooth. And if you have a bare soil, you have a pretty equal smooth seed and appendage seeds in that resulting species composition mix in that community. So it's not those, that bare soil is not discriminating against any kind of seed. It's just kind of whatever is out there falls on the bare soil, everybody's happy and does just fine. As soon as you get a cyanobacterial crust, you start screening out those appendage seeds. And now you're down to a much smaller proportion of appendages to smooth seeds. And by the time you get to a lichen, you're doing it even worse, but now you're even screening out, well, no, those two are pretty equal that way. But by the time you get to a moss, not only are you screening out appendage seeds, you're also screening out some of the smooth seeds. So they're really determining to a large extent the composition in those plots of the plant community. And then if you think about what I was saying, these guys are really easily disturbed. So now we have this shifting matrix through time and space, basically. You stop the crust and you're going to revert it back to bare soil. And so then everyone can get in. And then there you've got this tension as succession proceeds. It's going to start screening out more and more plants of certain kinds. And then it gets stomped again, and then it goes back to the beginning, and it takes all seeds. And so you've got these two tensions. You've got one going forward with disturbance and one going back with succession. And so, you know, you've got this really cool way of looking at dryland plant community composition. If it's true in other places, it certainly seems to clearly be true in this particular desert. And I would just love it if people would take this forward and see if it's true other places. Because it would be pretty awesome to find that something so little can control the whole show. Because as Jeff said, we really do have to admit it. And I hate to too, because, you know, I want these guys to be, you know, Max, king of the universe. But the plants in the end are pretty much the show driver. But maybe we do. Wouldn't that be great? That'd be awesome. Anyhow, and then, like I said, you know, this also has huge implications for invasion. So if you're running around and you're either using climate change to get rid of the mosses and lichens, or you're smashing them, then we can also expect increased invasion of these large seeded plants. So basically, I used to always say this here, that, you know, there's a system and there's all this important stuff happening in the soil and, like, you know, it's the most important stuff ever, and I actually published that, and now my next publication, or my, I should say my last publication before I retire is going to be all the things I told you that were wrong. And so I'm going to have that picture over there in it, where I put this big X on all the other stuff and go, nope, it's all about soil crust. They're like it. And that if we mess with them, we really are, it can expect really profound changes for dry lands, whether it be nutrient cycles, plant composition, or whatever. Thanks.